Welcome to Worlds Apart. As the war in Ukraine approaches its 6 month mark, the only party that seems to be eager and willing to mediate it is Turkey, which is all the more astonishing given that Ankara continues selling weapons to Ukraine and growing its trade with Russia, while also remaining a willing, although a bit disruptive, member of NATO. Is there something about the zeitgeist that President Erdogan understands and others don't? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Bilgehan Öztürk, a researcher at the SETA Foundation for Political, Economic and Social Research in Ankara. Mr. Öztürk, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Now, one of the most cited and popular metaphors in Turkey's political vernacular is that of a bridge between East and West, between political religiosity and secularism, etc. And while I don't think that Turkish policy is as poetic, I think it can be pretty cynical at times, I do think it's remarkable in the sense of being able to reconcile the irreconcilable and hold the opposites that other countries are not able to hold. What do you attribute that to?
Well, I personally don't like the metaphor of being a bridge. And there were periods that Turkey preferred other metaphors rather than a bridge based on their transforming worldview and transforming perception of their own capacity and power. That's why there are a number of people who don't agree with the metaphor bridge, and I'm one of them.
Okay, which one would you prefer for the current times? Which metaphor do you think describes the current stance of Turkey the best?
Rather than metaphor, for a very long time, many Turks preferred a rather more active, you know, role attributed to Turkey. So, being a bridge is kind of a passive metaphor. It's basically a bridge is something where, you know, vehicles, you know, people just, you know, pass over. So Turkey does not obviously want to be such a passive being. It has its own claim for itself. It has certain things to contribute to the world when it comes to its international stature, so on. So that's why, rather than a metaphor, Turkey and some Turks prefer a Turkey that has its own national interests. It is capable of pursuing its own national interests, but at the same time being a meaningful and valuable member of international community. In the previous decades, we used to conceptualize this as Turkey must be a core country rather than a bridge, and, you know, in line with the increased claim or assertiveness in its foreign policy. So that's a little bit summing up of how we think about this.
Now, while we haven't been able so far to come up with a metaphor, I think one term that would describe Turkey's stance at this point of time is edgy, because President Erdogan has done things that are pretty polarizing. I mean, he was pretty straightforward in calling on NATO to resist the so-called Russian aggression in Ukraine. And at the same time, he managed to not only maintain, but I think deepen his dialogue with the Kremlin. Is that about the personality of the leader, or is it something institutional, you know, a country stance rather than the influence of the particular personality?
I would say both, because there are certain elements, even in the opposition, who appreciate how President Erdogan is handling this issue. But at the same time, there are still opposition figures who called for full engagement with the Western bloc, so to speak, against Russian stance. So I would say both. There are elements both in person, both in his personality and Turkey as a country. I would say, as a country, what he's been doing has been appreciated by the wider public. But at the same time, it depends on his personality, his skill of managing these contradictory worlds and stances. And when it comes to his, let's say, why not NATO is doing enough, he was basically calling for consistency rather than being hawkish against Russia. So as a NATO member, of course, there are members who we would call as warmongers, but at the same time, nothing or things were not enough to, let's say, meet the worst. That's why President Erdogan was calling for action, just to let's say invite the other members to consistency.
Well, he was pretty provoking in this regard. But if we are serious, what kind of action do you think he was calling for? What kind of action NATO could really take to deter the so-called Russian aggression?
No, it's because Turkey is a NATO member, and when there are certain NATO members who are calling for, let's say, military actions to support Ukraine, Turkey was aware that it would have to, you know, it would somehow influence Turkey or impact Turkey's policy or constrict the area of maneuver. That's why, and this is what President Erdogan has done in the past, you know, very frequently, calling out some contradictions,
yeah,
especially
absolutely.
When it comes
catching their bluff, to put it more crudely. Now, you wrote recently that the war in Ukraine hit Turkey where it hurts the most, that is the economy, driving up the energy prices and decreasing the flow of tourists from both Russia and Ukraine. But there are also some upsides. For example, the sales of Turkish drones and other weaponry have increased dramatically. The prominence of Turkey as a natural gas hub also has risen, especially in the aftermath of the EU's decision to decrease its reliance on Russia's energy sources. On balance, has it really been all that negative for Ankara?
On balance, I would say it's not clear yet, but I can only agree that there are both ups and downs. But I would say that downs and negative sides are much more prevalent. On those points that you mentioned, I can't agree with them fully, because in terms of drone exports, even without the Ukrainian crisis, the drone exports were doing really well, and actually there is no direct relation with a Ukrainian war with drone exports of Turkey. That's why I think Turkey definitely would prefer the absence of war for its export of drones rather than the presence of war. And at the same time, when it comes to Turkey being a hub of natural gas or transfer for the European natural gas needs, in theory, yes, other hubs, other let's say markets will be important. But in practice, we haven't seen yet any sustainable or concrete project that is put in place that Turkey could tap. So far, that's why the two main purported advantages you mentioned, I don't think on those accounts Turkey benefited. That's why negative sides are much more greater for Turkey than the positive sides.
Well, if I may to just mention that you seem to be a little bit reserved about the whether the Ukrainian conflict has led to the increased sales of Turkish drones. And I can say from Russia's experience that Russia's participation in Syria has dramatically contributed to rising sales. And there is nothing particularly shameful there, because once you demonstrate the efficacy of your product on the battlefield, many countries, and in fact, I've seen some statements coming from countries that are willing to purchase your equipment, saying that they've seen those drones in action, and that is what influenced their decision. I'm not suggesting that Turkey is benefiting from this war purposefully, but there are obviously some indirect benefits also when it comes to weapon sales. Now,
If I may, yeah. That is the exact point why I don't think Ukrainian war, increases sales any. Because when it comes to showcasing your product's efficacy and marketing it, Karabakh, Libya, Syria were all already, you know, quite enough. And in Ukrainian crisis, to be fair, Turkish drones are not at the very forefront. That's why I think if there are any impact of Ukrainian crisis positively, to speak, on Turkish drones export, it is very minimal. That's why I said, even without the war, that's why, and we would prefer the absence of war for even for the sake of exporting Turkish drones.
Well, I think we would prefer that too. I mean, if Russia could solve this issue in any other way, I'm sure it would do that. Speaking of which, I remember when the war in Syria was proceeding, Turkey was very vocal that its security concerns there were impinged upon by the Americans, by their dealings with the Kurds, by their arming of the Kurds, by forming certain areas that could be used for attacks against Turkey's mainland. And I think back then, Moscow was pretty accommodating of Ankara's concerns up until a certain point. Now we have a situation in Ukraine where Russia for years have been saying that its security interests in Ukraine are being violated by the West arming Ukraine and using it, at least from Moscow's perspective, as a proxy platform for an aggression, for a negative stance against Russia. Do you think those issues are comparable, the Kurdish question and the Ukrainian question? Could they be compared?
I would like to state, firstly, I'm a close follower of Syrian issue. That's why I know the details and time span of the events. And that's why I have a reservation of your statement about when it comes to Russian being much more accommodating to Turkey's national interest, because there were pretty clear incidents that, threatened Turkey's interest, Turkey's assets on the ground. And yes, basically, Turkey is much more suffering from United States-sponsored part of the PYD, YPG presence. But that is not the only Turkey's national interest or security interest in northern Syria. The influx of refugees is another issue. And I would say in Idlib, for example, Russian-sponsored, Russian-backed Assad regime bombardments have been much more damaging to Turkey's interest of security at times, more than probably YPG threat. So in that sense, yes, vocally speaking, when it comes to discourse and narrative, yes, Russians are much more accommodated to Turkey's national interest. But when it comes to practice, the picture is not that clear.
Absolutely, and you never get everything. I mean, I think to some extent, Russia and Turkey present a very interesting pair of countries that have at times divergent security interests. And we all remember, at least in Russia, the 2015 incident of Ankara shooting down a Russian fighter jet over Syria, and how relations deteriorated almost overnight. Turkey became an enemy almost overnight, and yet the two countries have been able to walk that back and resume some practical cooperation. What do you think allowed for that? And do you think that could serve as, let's say, a model for other conflicts?
Well, that tells you enough about the complexity and specialty of this relationship. It includes both elements of competition, and even conflict, but at the same time, it involves the elements of cooperation. On the one hand, and I call this third theaters, a third areas of interest. In those third areas of interest, Turkish-Russian interests are quite conflictual. In almost all third geographies, regions that we have interest, we find ourselves on the other side of the camps. On rival camps. But when it comes to bilateral relations, we have very deep, very strong relations. And that's why, and for the sake of, I believe, for the sake of those critical and strategic cooperation areas in bilateral relations, we tend to overcome the difficulties and differences over third areas and regions. And when it comes to even the height of crisis such as the downing of the Russian jet, I believe the existence of those critical strategic bilateral ties helped both sides to overcome this difficulty. And at the same time, as a very determinative factor, I believe, the personal chemistry between President Erdogan and President Putin. So when it comes to Turkish-Russian relations and their strength, I believe Erdogan and Putin bilateral, you know, relationship is very determinative, to the extent that if both leaders are out of office, we can't you know, let's say, picture the same level of engagement on both sides of the relations.
Well, Mr. Öztürk, on that point, I actually disagree with you strongly, but we will continue our discussion in a few moments after a short break. Stay tuned.
Forward to talking to you all.
That technology should work for people.
A robot must obey the orders given it by human beings, except where such orders would conflict with the first law.
Show your identification.
We should be very careful about artificial intelligence.
The point, obviously, is to create trust rather than fear.
I would like to take on various jobs.
I mean, with artificial intelligence, we are summoning the demon.
A robot must protect its own existence as own existence.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Bilgehan Öztürk, researcher at the SETA Foundation for Political, Economic and Social Research in Ankara. Mr. Öztürk, before the break, you mentioned this unprecedented personal relationship between President Putin and President Erdogan. And let me quote you here. In one of your recent articles, you suggested that Putin knows no one who is more reliable and trustworthy than Erdogan. And I don't know how you know what Putin knows, but I know from my sources that President Erdogan is perhaps one of the least trusted leaders for the Kremlin, but that is what makes dealing with him so much easier, because it's not about trust or principle for the Kremlin. It's about sober calculation of your partner's interests and motivations and trying to meet them halfway, you know, have certain things for yourself and also making sure that your partner is satisfied to at least to some extent. Aren't you idealizing the personal relationship between Putin and Erdogan?
I agree with what you said. I mean, it is a result of the outcomes are the result of a calculation and knowing your partner well. But I still think that there is an extra element in this personal relationship that is maybe lacking in other personal relationships. Both Erdogan and Putin, let's say, respect each other as respectable leaders. And when it comes to, and I can't speak for President Putin, obviously, but I can speak for President Erdogan as I know him as a Turkish citizen and an observer of his politics. And he's a leader who is personalizing his relationships with other leaders. And when his trust is betrayed, he is you know, very greatly annoyed. And there are consequences in those occasions. And that's why I believe, despite all those difficulties between Turkey and Russia, these two leaders somehow managed to, let's say, you know, solve their problems. And this is based on their, let's say, track record with one another. For the past, let's say, experience of in their relationships, I believe both leaders think that when we agreed on something, the other one will deliver, will keep his word. And I think this is not always the case between leaders. And that's why I believe these two leaders, despite all the differences, they hold this element dearly, mm-hmm. both Erdogan and Putin. And that's why I think, that's why I uttered that word that Putin knows no one more trustworthy than Erdogan. I think if there's one thing for sure, both leaders know that the other one will keep his word, and it means a lot to them.
Well, again, this is something that is pretty contestable, because if you remember back in 2015, Putin described that attack by Turkish armed forces against the Russian jet as a stab in the back. It was a betrayal of trust for him, and for him as a person, not just as a leader, but as a person, as a man. That was huge. But I think the reason why they have been able to overcome that is because both leaders have an ability to put their country's interests before their personal sentiments. So regardless of whether they like each other or not, they see the value in collaborating with one another. Speaking of which, do you think that incident of 2015 is taken into account by the Turkish strategists as they devise their strategy in the Ukrainian conflict? Because for now, Ankara has been pretty artful in balancing its interest in Ukraine, its interest in Russia, its interest with the West. But as history shows, it can turn into Russia's enemy almost overnight.
About the incident, I understand that there was the Russian side of the story as the stab in the back, and we also followed those coverages at that time. But there was also the Turkish side of the story, and incidents and crises or accidents happen in every relationship. And if you ask the Turkish side of the story, and they would reply that there was an unidentified warplane. It was constantly violating the airspace. That's why we had no choice but to down it. So there are two versions of the story. And when it comes to whether it can be likened to the fighter jet and the current situation and its possibility to turn into a conflict between the two sides, I don't think so. I mean, not just because of the accidents in the past, the downing of the fighter jet, but at the same time, Turkey, after those incidents, and it's been years, and in Turkish-Russian relations, many things happened since then. We had closer relations. We had an experience of working together in the format of Astana. We had other mechanisms, and even Turkish Citrine, for example. After that incident, so many things happened, and I think the trust and the relationship, or the regime of the relationship, matured and gained a lot of experience. And that's why I think the accident or the incident, I don't think it's repeatable, but not just because it has become a trauma that Turkey is basically fearful of repetition of it, but Turkey is viewing Ukrainian crisis in a completely different, let's say, framework. That's why I don't think it is comparable to Syrian issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Syrian issue was also pretty complex, and I would suggest that the complexities have some similarities. Nevertheless, as I said, Turkey has been pretty good at balancing its interest in Ukraine and in Russia. But when we look at the trade side of things, and we know the Turks as pretty shrewd businessmen, I've read somewhere, I think it was in Harvard Business Review, that the big international companies prefer to hire Turkish executives because they are good at risk taking. They can push risk to the limit, but also take necessary precautions. So Turks are pretty good when it comes to business, and their trade with Russia is four times larger than their trade with Ukraine. For now, they've been able to sort of balance both. But if push comes to shove, do you think Turks would prefer to follow the money, or would they prefer to follow some sort of a principle that you often allude to in your writings?
And again, when we talk about balancing, that is the core interest of Turkey. I understand that if you just compare the importance of the two countries to Turkey based on trades, the picture is clear, but the reality is not that clear. Not only trade when it comes to our energy projects, when it comes to our defense, cooperation in the form of S-400s and other trade and tourism, so on and so forth. The relationships are manifold, and even based on that, there is no comparison. But these reasons are not the ones determining Turkey's attitude towards this war. The war is damaging and hurting for Turkey's national interests. It is happening in the immediate neighborhood. It has geopolitical consequences. And Ukraine is another dear and valuable partner for Turkey. So Turkey basically does not want to choose between the two, and it is gaining its strength based on this balancing between the two sides. So it doesn't want to basically choose between the two, and no matter how big the trade with Russia and even other cooperation areas, this is not necessarily a reason to, let's say, ditch Ukraine for the sake of mm-hmm. Russia. Now, balancing is the core interest here. Mm-hmm.
And I don't think Russia is actually pushing or pressing Turkey in that direction. Russia's foreign policy is also based on balancing, but there is another big player there, by which I mean the United States and the West in general, which is willing to make sure that other countries make a distinctive choice. Now, a few days ago, as I'm sure you know, Turkey dropped its opposition to NATO's enlargement by acquiescing to Finland's and Sweden's membership. And I heard you say that it was done because Turkey's security concerns were listened to. But do you think Turkey's security as a member of NATO, as a country bound by the collective defense chapter 5, do you think its security will increase as a result of NATO enlarging? Because clearly that's not going to bring anything positive for the relations between Russia and NATO.
Well, Turkey is just pursuing a principled policy. Even if Sweden and Finland did not apply for membership, Turkey's principled position was favoring NATO's enlargement for the past years. That's why there is no inconsistency in that. The only point is, I'm sure you are well aware that Turkey does not have a categorical or principled opposition to Sweden and Finland, as long as they take into account Turkey's national interests and meet its demands. So that's why there is no, let's say, surprise there. If they agree, taking into consideration Turkey's national security interests, fine. Anyone welcome in NATO NATO alliance. So that's why it acquiesced to that memorandum, and whether it will let's say increase Turkey's security, that is another issue, and whether it will increase or decrease, I don't think there is such an impact. Mm-hmm. It is just basically maintaining your security as it is. You don't necessarily have to increase it, but as long as you make sure that you are secure, you can continue your role in this alliance.
It's interesting that this is pretty much how Moscow would frame its policy in Ukraine. You don't want to increase your security, but you want to protect the existing balance of power. But we are out of time for now. Thank you very much for your insights today.
Thank you.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.